Before the pyramids were built, before Rome was founded, before Jesus walked this earth, before courtrooms and contracts and complex laws, Hammurabi's code was etched into stone. This is the world's oldest legal code in existence, written 4,000 years ago in ancient Babylon. It was clear and absolute. You steal, you lose a hand. You break something, you buy it. You take someone's eye, you lose yours. From the beginning of time, people have attempted to define justice. Justice. Hammurabi laid the foundation, the Greeks built on it, the Romans refined it, and when this country was founded, lawyers were everywhere. John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton. Today, there may be even too many lawyers. This nation was founded by people who knew that without the rule of law, societies fall apart. And let's be honest, most of the time, we're grateful for society's attempts, even imperfect attempts at justice. But here's the thing. A jury can convict a murderer, but it can't bring back the life that was taken. A judge can deliver a sentence, but they cannot heal the wounds left behind by a crime. You see, society's justice is not the same as God's justice. God's justice goes farther. God's justice doesn't stop at punishment, but it moves towards redemption and reconciliation. God's justice doesn't just settle the debt, but it restores the debtor. But despite the transformational power of God's justice, so many of us are satisfied with, and in fact, we want the sort of justice that our world offers. We demand that things be made right. After all, don't we love the movies where at the end the bad guy or bad girl gets everything that's coming to them? And doesn't it feel great when the person who just cut you off in traffic then gets caught at a red light and you catch up with them? We want things to be right. We want punishment. We may even want retribution. And we call that justice. But God's justice goes farther. God's justice isn't about making things even, but about making people whole. Today we read the parable of the prodigal son, not the prodigal of the parable son. It's one of Jesus' greatest hits. But here's the thing about parables. They're not bedtime stories. And when we hear this story today, I don't think we always remember just how scandalous this would have sounded to the first people who heard it 2,000 years ago. You see, when the younger son asked for his inheritance, he wasn't just being selfish. He was saying, in essence, "Dad, I wish you were dead. Give me what's mine. I'm out. I'm done with this family." He turned his back on his family, on his community, on his responsibilities. So I want us to, for a few minutes, look at this parable again with fresh eyes. When the prodigal son left his home, Jesus doesn't give us all the details about the far-off country that he went to, but I imagine if he was telling the parable today, this far-off country might be Las Vegas. This son might have ended up in clubs, in casinos, eventually hooked on alcohol, and then drugs, then maybe even dealing drugs, taking advantage of people, doing whatever it took to keep the party going. And you can bet in this modern parable, his friends and his neighbors and his family back home would have seen glimpses of what he was doing on Facebook or Instagram. And then when he finally hit rock bottom, when he ran out of friends, out of money, out of opportunities, he came crawling back home. Now let me ask, if that was your son, and you saw that boy walking up your driveway, how would you respond? Would you throw a party and invite all your neighbors and your friends? Probably not. You might give him his room back if he agreed to go into a rehab program and get a job and get his act together. But that's not what the father in this parable does. The father runs and greets him in the middle of the driveway, and then he throws a party and invites all his friends and neighbors, everyone who on Facebook knew what this boy was doing. And then Jesus says that this boy was given a ring, a symbol of power, and a robe, a symbol of wealth. In the modern version, the father would make his son the vice president of the family company and give him a new car. In our world, that's not what we expect. That's not reasonable. That's not justice. But that's exactly Jesus' point. God's justice isn't reasonable. God's justice is different than ours. Over and over again in the Bible, when we expect retribution, instead, God offers restoration. When we expect judgment, God offers mercy. And that's what we see in the life of Jesus also. He didn't come to balance the scales. He came to tip them over entirely. He dined with sinners. He spent time with outcasts. He forgave those who didn't deserve it. And when he could have called down curses from the cross, he instead said, "Father, forgive them." You see, God's justice doesn't give us what we deserve. It gives us what we need to be made whole. It was 1993 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Laramie M. Byrd, a young man who had just turned 20 years old, had his life in front of him. One night, Laramie M. got into a fight with O'Shea Israel. O'Shea, only 16 years old, pulled out a gun and shot and killed Laramie M. Byrd. O'Shea was arrested. He was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 25 years in prison. That was justice. But let me ask you, what about Laramie M. Byrd's mother, Mary Johnson? Did O'Shea's conviction and sentence bring back her son, heal her pain, restore her broken heart? Here's the thing about the world's justice. It can punish, but it cannot heal. God's justice, on the other hand, isn't just about laws. It's about love. It's about forgiveness. It's about making people whole. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I had a project due at school early in the school year, and I wasn't exactly what you'd call prepared. I hadn't started it. To cover my failure, I discovered the art of creative storytelling. I think that's a good euphemism for it. I told my teacher, "Oh, I forgot my project. It's sitting on the kitchen table at home." I told my mother, "I turned in my project yesterday. My teacher already has it." It never occurred to me that these two could talk to each other. But they did. After discovering my deceit, my mother transformed into something straight out of the Old Testament. I'm talking fire from heaven, full-on prophetic wrath. I think if the prophet Jeremiah had walked into my house that afternoon, he would have backed out very slowly and said, "You know what, you got this one." After my mother finished her lecture, she took me outside. There was a pile of bricks. It looked more like a mountain to me at the time. And she told me, "I want you to move this pile of bricks from this side of the yard to the other." And I moved it for hours I worked until after the sun had gone out, gone down, and the stars had come out, until every brick was moved. I went to bed more exhausted than I'd ever been. And then the next morning, my mom woke me up, took me back out, and said, "Move it back." The world's justice had prevailed. I paid the price for my misdeed, and I certainly learned a lesson from that experience. But my mother didn't stop there. She took the next step. After making sure I understood that my actions weren't acceptable, she pulled me close, and she held me, and she told me that she loved me. In that moment, she'd made me whole again. And that's what God's justice looks like. So how do we hold these two truths at once? That we live in a world that needs laws, that needs courts, that needs structure to keep society from falling apart, and at the same time, as followers of Jesus, we're called not to just enforce the rules, but to go beyond them. How do we live in a society shaped by legal justice while also being citizens of a kingdom driven by divine justice? I'll be honest with you. I've searched through the Bible and I've read the commentaries and I've studied the theologians and I've prayed for countless hours, and I still don't know the answers to all the most difficult and vexing questions like this one. But here's what I do know. We can't simply accept the status quo. We can't simply assume that we live in a society that's based on a system of laws, and therefore that everything is taken care of and we have no responsibility and we're off the hook. We can't do that because the gospel won't allow it. Yes, the world may settle for its definition of justice, but our faith demands that we go further. Yes, society may punish, but Jesus calls you and me to help heal this world. The work of justice is not only up to the courts and the government and the legislators. The work of justice is yours and is mine also. That may mean in your life mentoring a kid who's gotten in trouble or on the verge of getting in trouble, or giving a second chance, maybe even a job, to someone who's been incarcerated, or being compassionate when everything inside you calls for you to get even. God's justice, real, holy, resurrection-shaped justice, doesn't stay locked up in a courtroom. It walks the streets, it gets its hands dirty, and you and I are called to be a part of that work. So no, we may not always know exactly what to do, but we do know the kind of people that God is calling us to be. People of mercy, people of grace, people who don't stop at what's fair, but move towards what heals. And that is an incredibly difficult calling. After serving 17 years of his 25-year sentence, Oshay Israel was released from prison for killing Laramiam Bird. You would expect that Laramiam's mother, Mary Johnson, would be furious that Oshay was released early, or that she would be bitter or seek revenge. But Mary was guided by a different compass, a compass that pointed towards divine justice. So she reached out to Oshay with a heart full of forgiveness and mercy and grace, and she invited him to move in next door to her. She promised to support and help him as he got his feet on the ground and reacclimated to life after prison. And eventually, both of them, side by side, began working together to prevent others from falling into cycles of violence. Their bond became so profound that Oshay began joining Mary Johnson at her church every Sunday as they worked together, and Mary Johnson began referring to Oshay as her spiritual son. Theologian N.T. Wright wrote, God's justice is a saving, healing, restorative justice. And Mary Johnson, in a real and concrete way, helped show what God's justice looks like. So friends, this may sound good in theory, but you may be wondering, what does this mean for us today? What does this mean for you and me? Why does this matter? Well, first, it matters because it changes the way we see God. If we understand that God's justice is restorative, that it's about healing, that it's about redemption, that it's about calling us back to Him, then we can see that God is waiting not to punish us, but He's running to embrace us. Second, it matters because it changes the way we treat those around us. If God doesn't treat us the way the world treats us, if God doesn't keep score and God doesn't write us off and God doesn't give up on us when we fail, then we should do the same to others. God tells us to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And third, it matters because it changes how we see ourselves and understand who we are. After all, God's justice searches for us. It runs to us while we're still a long way off. It forgives our past and welcomes us home. And in the words that Jesus spoke in the parable today, God's justice declares, "Let us eat and celebrate, for this child of mine was dead and is alive again. This child was lost and is found." Amen.